The Asian Classics Institute presents A Guide to the Bodhisattva Way of Life, Part 3, with Geshe Michael Roach. Recorded live in New York City in October of 1997. This is the beginning of Class 11.
Okay, we're going to go over the final tonight. People think it's a funny final because I give them all the questions beforehand. But again, the purpose of the final is not at all to trick you or to, you know, to fake you out or something like that. I just want to identify the things that are most important and the things that I feel you really must retain and you must pass on to the next generation. So I don't mind if you know all the questions in advance. And in fact, you're going to get my answers to the questions tonight, to all the homeworks, so including the Tibetan. Okay? By the way, if you haven't done some of your homeworks, please don't just Xerox it into the place. Okay? At least misspell a few words. We've misspelled a few for you. So it's not at all my intention to trick you. I often tell people, when I had my Geshe examination, it was 900 monks there. Some students came. It was 7 days of examinations, oral examinations, and the last day was in front of all 900 at once. Anybody can come up and challenge you. And I had a good time, and I didn't miss too much. They said, "How did you do that?" You know, and I said it was teaching these courses because, if the Geshe exams were held in English and if you had, a bunch of years to study it, anyone could do it. And frankly, there's nothing in the Geshe exam that you're not getting. You see what I mean? So these are the questions that a Geshe would be getting in his or her final exam. Okay. And that's all I really want. You know, I want that you all know the answers to what a normal monk would know after finishing his studies. So that's really the function, and that you can, frankly, I tend to ask more or to repeat more the questions that are necessary for your own enlightenment in this life, you know. So I'm really concentrating on the things that you need to enter a Buddha paradise before you die. And That's all. That's the basis upon which the exam is designed. All right? So, the first question has to do with view of destruction. If you remember, it's a jikta in Tibetan. There's two explanations of why it's called jikta. One is that it will fail. Eventually it will wear out, you know. It is ignorance. It is the first link in the wheel of life. It's the blind guy with the cane. And that's, you need to know what that is. It is the tendency to see you and the things that are part of you as being self-existent, because that's the one that causes you all the trouble. As long as you think that way, you will do bad karma and dirty good karma. As long as you think that way, you will never enter a Buddha paradise in this life. Okay. The things that make you happy, the things that you want to reach in your life, the things that you want to get, getting them depends on understanding who you are. And you are not the result of external, independent factors. You know, whether or not you get a milkshake at Michael and Zoe's tonight depends not on the money you have. It doesn't depend on whether you have a car to get there. It doesn't depend on whether they're open when we let out. It doesn't depend on any of that. You know, a milkshake going down your throat into your stomach depends solely and only on your whether or not you served other people in your past. And you have to get used to that. Any other Michael Roach, you see what I mean, doesn't exist. A Michael Roach who could get a milkshake, A, because he has the money, B, because he has a car to get there, 3, because they're still open when I get there, those things don't even exist. And to fight to defend them, and to fight to make sure they're happy, and to try to fight to get a car, or fight to get out on time, or fight to get money, those are all like delusion, deluded acts. You know, they're insane, because there's nobody like that. The person that you're doing them for doesn't even exist any more than a two-headed purple elephant exists in this room. That person doesn't exist. The person you've been fighting to defend, the person you've been struggling to make happy and comfortable, that person doesn't exist. Okay, that's jikta. Jikta thinks it does exist. Okay, and jikta thinks he can make you happy through those external things. That's not the point. If you want a milkshake, you must help other people who are hungry, or like that. You have to do that. Okay, that's. But jikta thinks the opposite. You should know there the Tibetan word for nirvana, and it's there. And of course, you understand nirvana is permanently destroying your own negative emotions. Okay, basically, because you've seen emptiness directly. Okay. Next question involves the two truths. Are they actually two different kinds of truth? Are they truth? Maiji?
The ultimate truth is the truth. The other truth is just words.
Okay. Well, truth is a deceptive. Get it? Truth. The word truth is deceptive. They are not two principles or something like that. They are actually two realities. Everything is either ultimate truth or deceptive truth. You see what I mean? So really they mean reality, a kind of reality. Why are they called truth? One of them is called truth because if you see it, you can reach liberation. Can you? What would it be like to reach liberation in this life? You would enter a Buddha paradise. You know, your body would actually change. And the process by which it changes is very tied up with what Ken Rinpoche taught last Sunday. Okay? The process through which you're... I mean, there's a special process. It's very specific. There's very specific elements involved, very specific parts of your inner body. And Rinpoche was covering those the last class when he did the Lukyo. He was covering that. It's a very specific process. It really does work. You start to change because of certain things. And that's, it works. It really works. So you have to see ultimate reality for that to begin, for that process to work. You can change. You will change. When I say enter a Buddha paradise, I'm not joking. You know what I mean? I had a publisher came today to talk about writing books, you know, and they want to write these books, you know, and I don't know if they got it. Some people were there, but that the real goal of writing a book would be that it's, that people who read it could get to Buddha paradise, and it was really, they seemed to be very surprised that that would be the reason to write a book about Buddhism, you know, and no, it was very. I don't know how many Buddhists in this country really, honestly believe that they don't have to die, you know, really honestly believe that they could become all those tantric deities, and that that's the whole point of practicing, you know, and that you should try to get to the highest teachings as quickly as possible and not be shy about it, you know. I don't know, but anyway, so ultimate reality is ultimate because it's really true, and if you see it, then it makes you enlightened. The other reality is called reality because ignorance thinks it's true. You see, it's called truth because ignorance thinks it's true. But it's deceptive. What is it? It looks like you get a Michael and Zoe's strawberry protein shake if you have the money. But that's not what causes the shake. What causes the shake is only one thing, and that's your goodness. Okay? How does it cause the shake? It gives you karma, which stays in your mind, which makes you see a red circle as a Michael and Zoe's milkshake. Okay? It's not a Michael and Zoe's milkshake until your karma makes you see it that way. And that's the only rule that's running our lives. No other rule is working here. The only rule that's running your life is the emptiness of the things around you and your karma making you see things. And there is no other principle in life. Ignorance thinks everything else. Anything else. God made the milkshake, money made the milkshake, cow made the milkshake, you know, hard work makes a milkshake, you know, having a car to get there makes a milkshake. It's all a lie, and that's deceptive, you see? And your mind believes it, and that's not true. Okay, that's all. What object is divided into the two truths? So there's a big debate in the monastery. Is truth itself divided into the two truths? And the answer is no, because one of them is a lie. Okay. It's a big joke in the monastery. He said, name the two truths. And you say, yeah, dhamma. Is it a division of you know, these two kinds of truth? Duh, it is. So they're truth, right? Because they're divisions of truth. They're not. Okay. You know, it goes like that. It's like gunfire in a real debate. You know, it's like, you know, can you divide truth? They say, yeah. Let's see. Okay. Oh, you're telling me it's deceptive truth and ultimate truth. Duh, that's right. Duh, and then you say, oh, are those kinds of truth? Demi yao yimbata. And they say, duh, right, that's right. Say, demi yimbata. You know, you get them up to the edge, and then they say, yeah, yeah, it's a kind of truth, and then you push them off. You know? No, they're not kinds of truth. Yeah. Kuzo demi yimbata. Are you telling me that deceptive truth is true? And they say, duh. Yinte, why? They say, right, it is. And you say, why? And they say, because it's a division of truth. You say, oh, demi yao yin, demi yimbata. If it's a division of truth, is it a kind of truth? You say, yes. You say, oh, this must be true, right? You say, yes. So you say, Michael and Zoe milkshake, chuchin. You know, let's discuss this milkshake, you know. So it doesn't, it's not deceptive reality, right? They say, chuchin. You say, why? Because it's true, okay? It really exists the way you thought it did. And then they get into trouble, okay? There's a gacha yimata. Gacha yata. Are you telling me the thing that emptiness is empty of exists? Okay. And they say, duh, you know. And then you get in big trouble like that. Okay, anyway. It's fun to watch somebody get in trouble on the debate ground, you know. Okay. If you're like sadistic, okay. Give a special quality of ultimate truth as described by the great Gelsabje. I'm just going to read it directly. That object which is such that if you realize it directly, it functions to allow you to finish off all your impurities, meaning all your mental afflictions, forever. And your inability to see all objects. Okay. If in this lifetime, any person in this room can spend 20 minutes in the presence of ultimate reality with a direct perception, then you have joined the elite, you know, which are Arya, Pakpa. At that moment, you become two of the three jewels. When people, Buddhists all over the world, prostrate, take refuge, pray, they're praying to you. Okay, why? You're out. You're out of here. Gyunshuk, right? Gyunshuk, stream enterer. You're out of here. It's just a question of a short lifetime, one lifetime, maybe seven, typically seven. You're out of here, you know. And all those lifetimes are like wonderful, fantastic, spent in the presence of holy beings, you know. Very, very happy lifetimes, spent in the practice of the Dharma, you know. And no problems after that, nothing, okay. And you see it directly. So if you can spend 20 minutes with that, it would polish off all your problems. Okay, number four. Oh, that's where it gets into, describe the two kinds of people that result from the two viewpoints, you know, the two viewpoints. One being ignorance, one being wisdom, right, basically. If you can see emptiness directly, Arya, Pakpa, I call it realized being, not that they are enlightened. I distinguish between a realized being and an enlightened being. In my mind, you're realized if you've realized emptiness directly, but you're not enlightened yet, okay? And then the opposite of that is a Sosokyo, also known as a Tsurtong, also known as a Chiba. Infant, short-sighted person, or so-so, okay? Normal person, okay? And everybody's one or the other. Everybody is one or the other. If you're a Sosokyo, if you don't see emptiness directly before you die, and you ask me, how's my chances, you know? Can't say. You will suffer immensely. Okay? The Kepen Chimbo means this is a high-risk investment, this life. You know, either you're going to win a jackpot or you're going to suffer incredibly. There's basically only two things that can happen. You know, either you enter a Buddha paradise in this life, which everyone in this room is quite capable of doing, especially if you understand emptiness, or you're just going to suffer very, very bad, seriously, after that. So it's you have to try to become an Arya in this life. Okay. Number five, summarize the argument of the mind-only school when they object to the middle way school, Madhyamika. Madhyamika says there's two realities. One is deceptive because it's deceptive to the mind of a person who doesn't understand emptiness. They run around New York City trying to collect self-existent money from a self-existent job to buy a self-existent house and stay with a self-existent family and then die a self-existent death, okay? You know what I mean? And none of the actions they undertake has anything to do with those getting those things. Okay? So they are actually struggling to make things happen that could never happen because the things they're struggling for don't exist. And you don't have to be like that. Okay? So the mind-only school objects to the middle way school. They say, if everything is like that, you know, if I suddenly wake up this morning and I realize that all this money I've been working for doesn't even exist. By the way, does money exist? Of course. Can you use money to buy things? Of course. But does it exist the way you thought it did? Not at all. Okay. Can you get it by working hard? No, lots of lazy people get rich. Can you get it by lazing around? No, lots of lazy people are poor. You see what I mean? It's not no connection there. Generous people never get poor. That's hard. Okay. Generous people are never poor. According to Buddhism, it's impossible to be generous and not be prosperous. And you have to get used to that. Oh, but we see lots of generous people that are poor. Not really. If you practice it sincerely, and if you understand the emptiness of your generosity, it's pretty much impossible to remain poor. Okay? If you do it in a wimpy way, if you don't do it on a steady way, if you don't do it with wisdom, and you don't understand the emptiness of generosity, it may not give the results you hope for. That's true. Okay, and that's what Master Shantideva said, right? Okay. Okay, mind-only school complaining to the Madhyamika school. What state of mind understands that everything is a lie? Okay, what state of mind understands that when you give money to get a Michael and Zoe's milkshake, it's not the money that's causing the milkshake? Okay, what's the state of mind that understands that? And you say, well, it's a kind of intellectual understanding about dependent origination, karma, whatever. And they say to us, is that state of mind itself ultimate reality or deceptive reality? And we say it's deceptive reality. And they say, well, if it's deceptive reality, then the way it seems is not the way it is, right? And we say, yeah, when you're focusing on that state of mind as an object, it's true that you're not seeing it the way it really is. Oh, well, then how is it? You think those thoughts are you, but they are really just karma ripening and forcing you to hear those thoughts in your mind. And the day you reach nirvana, your karma will be forcing you to hear your thoughts as pure. Your mind also is just like the milkshake. So in that sense, when you think about your thoughts, you don't think of them right. You think they are some kind of independent thoughts that could exist by themselves without your projections of your karma. But in fact, they are only the projections of your karma onto moments of consciousness. Okay? And they say, well, then your mind is part of deceptive reality, right? We say, right. So when that mind realizes the truth about Michael and Zoe's milkshakes, it's deceptive reality, right? You say, right. So they say, then it's wrong, right? And we say, no, it's right. Okay. And they say, well, how can it be deceptive reality and be right? It's right because, in a deceptive way, it's understanding how things really work. Okay, and you have to get used to that. It is deceptive reality because it appears to be independent and it's not. But the conclusions which it draws are totally correct. No problem. You'll see in the final reading, if you ever get it, that, you know, in a dream, people were describing me dreams recently. They said, in a dream, I was about to break a vow. And I've been concentrating so much on my book that twice in a dream I didn't break the... You know, I actually thought to myself, I'm not supposed to do this, and I stopped. You see, in a dream, the thought not to commit a breaking of your vow can happen. And then you don't break the vow in your dream. You see, are they real? You see, is the dream real? No. But can it function inside the dream? Yeah. Okay? So you can, it's true that your mind is deceptive, and it's true that your mind doesn't even understand how your mind works, even while your mind is understanding how the milkshake works. Okay? But that doesn't mean that the conclusion it draws are false. They're correct. It's just that every part of the conclusion, you're misperceiving it also. Okay? But that's not a problem. It does not make it invalid. If you don't think so, go stand out in front of a non-self-existent taxi cab barreling down the street and see if it breaks your legs or not, and come back and report to us what happens. Okay? Of course they function. They're not what you thought they were. They do function. Okay? So they say the illusion cannot exist because the mind seeing it is screwy. But it's screwy with regard to being an object of your mind and not in regard to its conclusions. Okay? A little touchy. How does the middle way school answer this objection? Next question. They don't sit there and argue projections and karma and emptiness with the mind-only school. Okay? They don't do that. They say, oh, Mr. Mind-only school, do you guys have any kind of illusion that you think exists? You know, like, you know, do you guys teach about any kind of illusions? And they say, yeah, you know we teach about illusion, but not the way you guys do. So they say, well, tell me what you think illusion means. And they say, well, it means that the karma which is producing my eyeball and my eye consciousness and the karma which is producing that pew are the same karma. One karma is producing the object and the subject at the same time. Okay? It's this karma that stays in the special part of your mind, and it's like picture my body as one big pool of karma, right? And this karma creates an eye consciousness, and then the same pool of karma over here creates a pew, and then it's the eye consciousness is perceiving the pew, but they're both made of the results of one karma. They're coming out of one karmic pool. In a sense, you're watching yourself. In a sense. That's what mind only means. Okay. But most people never realize that, so world is like an illusion. Okay. The world is like an illusion because most people never get it, that the karma that's creating them and the karma that's creating them world is the same thing. It's one karma. One karma is creating both. But no, most people never get it, and they live in a world where it seems like the guy that's sitting in the world and the world around the guy are separate and distinct from each other, and they're not created by the same karma. And that's an illusion. So they say, we do have an illusion. So then we say, well, how do you see this illusion? You know, how do you get it? Because isn't that also just a karma going off? You know, how do you ever catch yourself doing it if your mind is also an illusion? Okay? You have the same problem as we do. You see, that's how Master Shantideva defeats the mind-only school. Your idea of an illusion is, according to you, just as bad as our idea of illusion, because catching yourself doing it would require a mind standing outside of the illusion. But according to you, there is no such mind. Okay? We say the mind doesn't have to stand out to see the illusion. The mind can be part of the illusion and catch itself seeing the illusion, being the illusion. No problem. We don't have a problem there. Okay? You say the mind can't be part of the illusion and still catch itself in the illusion. But that's wrong, because even in your idea of an illusion, the mind can't do that. Okay? So we defeat them by what's called Rigpa Gotsum, parallel reasoning. You know, we don't try to convince them of our middle Madhyamika viewpoint. You notice that? We're not trying to convince them that we're correct about projections and all that. We're just saying, if you complain to us about this process, you're complaining to yourselves, because you have the same beliefs. You have the same idea. Okay, we're not trying to defeat the mind-only school by arguing the Madhyamika school. We're defeating the mind-only school by pointing out that if we're wrong, you is wrong too. Okay, all right, that's all. Okay, I think question 7 is one of the most important questions, and we'll go over it in detail again. Maitreya, as he's paraphrased in a commentary to the Uttara Tantra, which is not a tantra, it's a plain old sutra book, he gives a 6-step process which causes all the suffering of mankind. Okay? And I think it's so cool, because it was the holy grail of Buddhism to me. It was the holy grail of all Buddhist practice, all Buddhist study, my whole life, to see the connection between karma and emptiness, you know. So if things are empty, what does that do for me? And if I study karma, who needs emptiness? You see what I mean? It didn't see any connection between the two. But the Buddha spent 25 years teaching one and 25 years teaching the other. There must be some connection, okay? And here's the connection. When I saw this, I was so thrilled. It's quoted in the textbooks of the greatest monastery in the universe, Sarame. Number 7. Relate the 6-step process described by Maitreya, which links the failure to perceive emptiness to the suffering that we have to go through. Okay. Step number 1. From your former life comes the bhakcha, the seed in your mind of the two kinds of ignorance. Okay. What are these two kinds of ignorance are thinking that Michael Roach is self-existent and thinking that Michael Roach's parts are self-existent. Okay. Number 2. These ripen early in this life, even in the womb, they are already ripened. And you think everything is self-existent. They ripen, okay? They activate. Number 2 is the activation of ignorance in your mind, okay? It's active now. How many living beings have this ignorance? Every sentient creature in the universe who's not a Buddha or an arhat has this ignorance, okay? Everybody has this. Amoebas, you know, single-celled animals, elephants, ants, whales, dolphins, birds, humans, hell beings, pretas, devas, everybody has it, yeah.
Are you saying that when you get there, you can see
yourself? Yeah, exactly. Bodhisattva levels 9 is for that. To get rid of the most subtle seed of it also. Yeah. So So it activates, okay? It means that even single-celled animals and tigers and bears are misunderstanding things, and they also collect bad karma. In order to swallow another amoeba, they think that they have to move over there and embrace them and digest them. And then sometimes they get killed. Okay? Why? That's not how you get to swallow another amoeba. You have to be nice to other amoebas. You see what I mean? But they can't figure that out. It's impossible. They have ignorance. I'm not kidding. Okay? I'm really not kidding. Even an amoeba is misunderstanding their world. And they are doing violence to other amoebas, thinking that that's how they can get food. But that's not how you get food. You don't get oil supplies by attacking Iraq. Okay? It's not how you get oil supplies. You get oil supplies by being kind to people and supplying them with the things they need and things like that. Okay? All right. Number three. Does that mean we shouldn't attack Iraq? That's a long question. Okay? That's a different question. Will it work? Maybe yes and maybe no. That proves it's not the cause of oil supplies. Okay? If you answer me, if I ask you, will it always work? And you say, Colin Powell, well, you know, we hope. Then you don't understand the cause of oil supplies. Because if you're a real scientist and you understand the cause of oil supplies, then every time you create that cause, you should get oil supplies. It's so obvious that it goes over the head of 3 billion people. Okay? All right. Yeah. Apparently, it just activates by the act of thinking in your new life, which occurs at the first moment of conception, because you're already having consciousness of the feelings. You see what I mean? It activates immediately. It activates in the first millisecond of this life, by the act of thinking. It infects every perception that you will ever have in your life, including the very first primitive perception in your mother's womb of warmth or discomfort or something like that. It's already activated. Okay? There is no perception that a normal human being has in their whole life which is not infected by this misperception. Okay. Number three. These cause you to focus on nice things and ugly things as if they existed from their own side. So you start misunderstanding the things you want and the things you don't want. Okay, so number three is a very basic misunderstanding of the things you want and the things you don't want. You think a milkshake comes from, you know, pushing into the front of the line, grubbing money off your friends, stuff like that, you know. That's not where it comes from. It comes from taking care of other people. If you really understood where a milkshake comes from, you'd want to make sure everybody at Michael and Zoe's got one before you. That assures your future supply of milkshakes. Okay? And that's the only reason you're getting one now. And if you cut in front of the line, it's not that you get a milkshake because you cut in front of the line. You're getting it because you offered other people the front of the line in the past. And if you cut in front of the line, it's the best way, the only way, and the most effective way to make sure you don't get served in the future. Get it? What would happen if the United States worked this way? You know, what would happen if international problems were dealt with this way? You see? If it's true. Okay. If it's true. And if I present it slowly, in terms of emptiness, you cannot prove it wrong. You can't. But anyway, I'll leave it at this. You feel that it could be right. Right? You got a sense of it. You have an instinct that it could be right. It sounds like it might be right. And try it. And if it doesn't work, then you can quit. Okay. Number four. This causes ignorant liking and ignorant disliking to start. Okay. Once you think a thing exists, a thing that you like or a thing that you don't like exists on its own side, from its own nature, then you can start to hate it or crave it. You see what I mean? Those negative emotions are only possible if you don't understand where it's coming from. If you go to Michael and Zoe's and you, under the influence of this class, you patiently wait at the end of the line and they run out of milkshakes just before you get there, okay, you'll get angry Why? Because you didn't get a milkshake. What milkshake? A self-existent milkshake. A milkshake that I would have gotten if I had cut in the front of the line. That milkshake doesn't exist. Okay? There's no such thing. It's the gakcha. It's a two-headed purple elephant rampaging through this room at this moment. Okay? What I'm trying to say is, if you were standing at the back of the line and you didn't get a Michael and Zoe's milkshake, and you kept your cool, I mean, if you understood the emptiness of the milkshake, you would never get angry. Impossible. I think you'd get a little sad. You know what I mean? But you would not be angry at the people who got them in front of you, and you would not be angry at Michael and Zoe. You'd be angry at, and you wouldn't be angry at God, who made it that way, and you wouldn't be angry at the Big Bang, and you wouldn't be angry at randomness, random violence of the world that you didn't get a milkshake, because that doesn't exist. All of the above don't exist. You would feel a little sad, and you'd feel a little frustrated with yourself. You see what I mean? I didn't purify that karma yet. I thought I did, you know, but I didn't. I mean, you allowed sadness. It's sad that suffering happens to you, even after you understand where it's coming from. You feel some sadness, but you don't feel anger or craving. You see what I mean? You can't feel upset in that way. You can't feel like stupidly, ignorant, blindly upset that causes more bad karma. And then you don't cause more bad karma. And then you're on your way out. Okay? So you can feel sad that you have to suffer, but you don't feel upset. You see what I mean? There's a difference. And you don't get angry. And you don't crave the thing. Okay? Craving implies, well, it comes next. Okay? E, these cause you to do bad deeds and collect karma. Craving implies you would hurt someone to get a milkshake. You know? You would do violence to another person to get anything you want. Meaning, you would push up to the front of the line, or you would demand to see the manager, or, you know what I mean, or something like that. You know, you have it advertised. I got here on time. My class let out early tonight, on time finally. Okay? And you would demand it, or you would hurt someone to get it. And that's collecting karma. That's the next step. If you understood the emptiness of milkshake, you would never hurt anyone to get it. Okay? Is it wrong to like things? Of course not. Buddhists like their Buddha paradises. Is it wrong to dislike things? Of course not. If you don't dislike suffering, you can't help anybody. Okay? Is it wrong to crave them or to be angry? Yes. Why? Because the thing you're craving for doesn't exist, and the act of craving and the act of anger will deny it to you in the future. Okay? So it's just stupid. Right? His Holiness says, try to reach a point of intelligent self-interest. Enlightened self-interest, he calls it. You know, cover your own rear end by taking care of other people. Okay. Which is not the only reason to do it, of course. I mean, if you understood, if what I speak tonight is true, it would be sadistic not to tell other people. You know, it would be sadistic not to help other people. You see what I mean? If it's possible that all these things are true, if this is the key to happiness, if this is the key to get Michael and Zoe protein strawberry shake anytime you want, you would not be a normal human being if you didn't try to help other people with it. You see what I mean? You would be weird. You would be somehow deficient. You would be less than a human if you didn't try to help other people with it. You know, if you ignored other people and watched them living out 70 years of suffering to get things that don't even exist, you would be a very strange person. You see? You'd have to be a really strange person not to want to help them. You know what I mean? Okay. Number six. Karma forces you to wander around in the circle of suffering. In other words, evil perpetuates itself. How? You get angry, you demand a shake, and then it gives its own result, which is that you don't get more shakes. You see what I mean? Bad karma, ignorance, is self-perpetuating. That's why the word for samsara, or this life in Tibetan, is korma, the cycle, self-perpetuating wheel. Okay? You, by your natural reactions to the disappointments of your life, you ensure future disappointments. You see? The natural reaction to anything you don't like is to create more of what you don't like. And until you can break that, you will always be suffering. Okay. All right, number 8. How does Master Shantideva answer the concern that meditating upon emptiness might feel a little scary? Okay, you've heard people say, especially if a person gets up and explains emptiness in a stupid way, in a wrong way, okay, then it can be a little scary. People can get like scared. If I stand up here and explain that if you really understand emptiness, I'm sorry, you're going to be forced into a tantric deity's body and mind before you die. You know, if I don't get up and say that, but I just get up and say, oh, it's like some black void, you know, and you will go off, watch your thoughts dissolve in your mind, you know, and float away, you know, and you read that, you know. I read it today, I mean, in a very, reputable magazine, you know. That would be scary. But that's not what Master Shantideva did. The answer he gives is, look, not understanding emptiness is scary. What's scary is to live a violent, chaotic, random, suffering life for 70 years and not know why and not have any hope of getting out and watching 3 billion other people race through the same torture track, you know, and get killed and maimed and kill each other and hate each other and never be happy for more than a few minutes at a time. Now that's scary. And that comes from not understanding emptiness. So don't give me this emptiness is scary crap. Okay? You know what I mean? The alternative is scary. You better see emptiness, okay? Much less scary than the life you're going to have to go through if you don't see it. Yeah. She says, what's the karma of teaching emptiness incorrectly? I'd rather answer it from the other way, which is, and I wanted to talk about it tonight, so, you know, there's always a tantric deity in the audience, but anyway, think about the opposite, okay? Think about the karma. I mean, I'm being a virtue pig as I speak, you know, I am, you know, we call virtue pig. These are the people who steal the check at the restaurant and stuff like that. Think of the karma. If what I say is true, okay, you don't have to believe what I say, but if it's true, if everything I said is true, if I have taught you in the last 6 weeks the exact roadmap for your own tantric body and enlightenment in this life, and if it really works, I want to see a t-shirt, by the way, okay? This stuff really works, okay? We're going to do it. Okay? Hey, this stuff really works. If it really works, consider the karma I'm collecting. You see what I mean? Like, if I wanted to speed up the process for good old Geshe Michael Roach, you know, and get his rear end into a tantric paradise like pronto, then this would probably be just about the smartest thing I could do would be to organize classes and make sure there's notebooks going out to correspondent students. And that would be really virtue pig, you know. If I really wanted the process to happen within this next year or within the next few months or something like that, it would be brilliant to teach the Bodhisattva Charvatara, you know, and collect that karma. So I'd rather concentrate on that. You know, think about that. You know, and frankly, it works, okay? It really does work, so try it, you know. I'm encouraging you to spread this viewpoint to other people, okay? Not the least reason for which, you know, you yourself, it'll start happening to you much more powerfully if you do it. The process will start to speed up. Whatever practice you're doing, if you're doing a dakye and all that, it'll start to speed up noticeably, amazingly, okay? And so I just taught you a secret, okay? And I'm going to collect more good karma from that. Okay? I'm not stupid. Okay. Number 9. Name and define the two forms of the tendency to grasp things as existing in truth. These are learned kinds of misperceptions of your world, and the natural one, that comes when you're born. Okay? We went through all the learned ones, and I can stand up here and say, I told somebody today, I'm Minjikpa. Minjikpa means I'm fearless about it. You know, I'm not afraid to stand up here, and I'm not ashamed or embarrassed to stand up here, and I'm not being a sectarian to stand up here and say that every single viewpoint that you currently hold in the West is absolutely mistaken. You know, and it leads only to your own suffering. And it, anyway, it doesn't explain half the stuff that goes on in the world. It's incomplete and it's dysfunctional. Why? Why is it incomplete? It doesn't explain why suffering happens to some people and not to others. It doesn't explain anything about why things happen. It doesn't explain to me why my mother died. It just does not explain it. It's incomplete. It's dysfunctional because there is no viewpoint in the West or in the East either, okay, outside of Buddhism, that explains how not to die. You know, out of 2,000 years of science or the development of rational, what you call rational in the West, has not made a human being live much longer, you know, what, 20 years more, okay, or be any happier. Especially not be any happier. I assert that people in 1997 are not in any way happier than people in 97, you see? So it doesn't work. Whatever that viewpoint is, it doesn't even bring a small comfort to people. I mean, it may be small, you know, maybe you die, you know, a little less, or, you know, a little older, slightly older. But it doesn't make people happy. People in the modern world, there's exactly the same percentage of unhappiness as there was 1,000 years ago. It has not brought happiness to people. It has not achieved the goals of a worldview. A worldview is not meant to impose itself on people. It's supposed to help people. People hold a worldview in order to be happy and to be prosperous. And those worldviews are dysfunctional. They don't work. They haven't made people any more prosperous or happy than they were 1,000 years ago. They don't work. They're incomplete and they're dysfunctional. Where did they come from? Those are the first type of ignorance, okay? The one that Mrs. Melvin taught you, okay? My friend came from Arizona. We grew up together since I was 10 years old. And he just came for the first time to New York yesterday, 30 years later, yeah? And Tessie picked him up at the airport and, you know, and everybody's pumping him for information about my early life, you know. And it's kind of funny. And they're checking to see if I really did have a first grade teacher named Mrs. Millman, who he doesn't remember, but he remembers Mrs. Butts in the fifth grade. But who taught you these worldviews? Where are they coming from? They are rumors. Incorrect, impossible, dysfunctional, incomplete, rumors that have been carefully spread from generation to generation without any examination. You know what I mean? You believe it only because of Mrs. Butts in the fifth grade and Mrs. Melvin, whether my friend remembers her or not, she was there. You only believe it for that reason. Think about it. You know, I'm even afraid to get up here and joke about God because, you know, I grew up with that and I'm still expecting, you know, a light to fall down on me or something, you know. It just doesn't exist, you know. If you went to a truly neutral culture and you explained to them your idea of this guy who invented the world and everything in it but didn't invent himself because he was already there and nobody invented him, but he does exist, and it gets crazy. It's silly. When I explained it to Tibetans, I was embarrassed, you know. And they kept asking me, well, is there more? I mean, did you leave something out? You know, and I'm like, after a while I stopped, you know. I just stopped explaining it to them, you know. And there were some other points. But anyway, I don't mean to, I'm not disparaging a tradition. You know, the morality teachings have brought happiness to many people for reasons they don't understand, okay. But if those teachings If you think about it, if what I say is true tonight, if the things I'm saying are true tonight, then in all those other viewpoints are responsible for the murder of millions of people. You see? The viewpoints are actually murdering people. And I'm not kidding, and I'm not exaggerating, you know. If this viewpoint is correct, then the others are wrong. And if they are wrong, then the deaths of millions of people are directly attributable to believing those things, you know, to having an educational system or a society or a culture where you teach children wrong viewpoint, that they can attain happiness through external factors and not by helping other people, and that any good thing that ever happens in your life is resulting only from serving others. To teach them any other viewpoint is to murder them, because they will die from that. It will cause their death, you see. Then it becomes very serious. That's very, very... that's worse than Hitler or something like that, you know. Mrs. Melvin is worse than Hitler. Unknowingly, unintended, with all good intentions, she is murdering her students in the first grade by teaching them a viewpoint which doesn't work. And they will die if they don't hear the other one. You see what I mean? Your responsibility becomes rather large as I speak, okay? Okay, number two is the innate one. It's been in your mind for beginningless time. It does not result from being taught by Mrs. Melvin, okay? It's not a viewpoint. It's the one you would have if you were that kid who was born in France and lived with the wolves the first 10 years of his life. It's a true story, right? And, you know, something like that. I mean, he didn't have any... Mrs. Melvin didn't get a hold of him. And he didn't believe in God, and he didn't believe in science, and he didn't believe that you could, in capitalism or socialism or communism or any other viewpoint of how wealth really happens. He didn't have all those. And you could say he only had the innate tendency to see things as self-existent. Okay. Number 10. Oh, yeah, naturally the next question would be, at what point in your spiritual career do you get rid of those wrong views? Okay. At what point do you dump the baggage? Okay. The learned ones die forever the day you see emptiness directly. Okay. Tonglam, Parchimelam, Kechik Dumbo in Tibetan. The first instant of the path of seeing. The process actually occurs later. I mean, you're conscious of it after you come out of that meditation, but you can never again entertain those thoughts. Okay. You can never again believe that that's what causes anything, you know. You can never again believe that doing a harmful deed to someone could ever give you a good result, okay? Impossible after that. So, at the path of seeing, upon the first direct perception of emptiness, you can never again have these wrong viewpoints, okay? And you see that this path is correct. And I'm not being sectarian. I would not say this at St. John the Divine if there were more people listening whose minds were not ready for it. But it is the only true path. It is the only true path. And there is a true path. And it works. Okay, and I'm not disparaging other paths. But if what I said is correct, the other ones have to be wrong. Okay. And I'm not trying to say, yay, you know, Buddhism or something like that. It's not my point. You know, I was a Christian. I was a good Christian. I worked hard at it. I was signed up for seminary. You know, I lived in the parish house. You know, it doesn't work. Okay, it just doesn't work. And it's a disservice to humanity not to present the correct viewpoint, which is you must do good things because things are empty. And they will create for you a Buddha paradise in this life, and you don't have to die. Think of millions of unnecessary deaths. You see what I mean? It's like when somebody, like a war, World War II, you know, I don't know what it was. Was it 50 million deaths or something like that? I don't know what it was, but it was all unnecessary, right? It was just a disagreement between a couple guys or something. But when you think of the carnage and the destruction and the death and the bloodshed and the fear and the hatred and the years of suffering, it was all unnecessary. The suffering of mankind is just as unnecessary. And any viewpoint which perpetuates it is like Hitler. It's like people who would start a war. You see what I mean? It's as And the horrible thing is that it's unnecessary. You know, people don't have to die like that. It's not, that's a, not true that people have to die. Okay. The point at which you eliminate the other kind of ignorance, which is to see in your mind a Michael and Zoe Shake as coming from your money, for example, or to see that it, or to believe that it's, it exists out there independent of your projections, that is only truly eliminated at the eighth bodhisattva level. Okay? At the eighth bodhisattva level. Okay. If you're on the Mahayana track, which you all are, so I don't have to talk about the other tracks. All right. Number 11. No Buddhist school agrees that there is a person which is distinct from the physical and mental parts of a person. For what I mean by that and what Master Shantideva means is that the thing that when they talked about a soul in school, in church, and if you were like me, you began to see some, I saw some crystal cylinder somewhere behind my stomach, you know, and it went up to about there, you know, because they told me you can't see it, and it's Michael, and it lasts forever, and when you die, it can go to heaven or hell, and you know, you started to create or imagine a Michael that was separate from your body and your mind. No Buddhist school says there's any such thing. So I didn't even ask a question about that, okay? But the middle way says that we are further neither any single one of our parts nor the whole of the parts. It's easy to see we are not any one of our parts. I mean, nobody in this room is like obsessed with being their thumb. You know what I mean? You know, you're not like having an identity crisis when your thumb, you know, is fingernails, the thumbnail's not looking right or something, you know. You don't think you're your thumb. That, we don't have that problem, luckily. Okay. But why is it the case that we are not the sum of all our parts? You know, this is the Janice Braden 7-year-old question, you know. Hey, Janice, am I all my parts together? And she says, yeah, you are. And I'm like stumped, you know. But, you know, years later I figure out the truth. She was wrong. Sorry, Janice. I'm not the sum of my parts. And that's why Madhyamika says, you are neither one, nor all of them, nor neither or both. Okay? Why are you not all of them together? You can, you know, it. There is blue and white and cylinder. All the parts are there. But it's not a pen, right? That's all. That's all. That's all it means. Until what? Until your karma forces you to see it as a pen. That's all. Somebody asked me, well, isn't that just like another part? So can't you say they are the sum of their parts if you include that perception as one of the parts? And that I have to say you're right. In that sense, that it is the sum of the parts if you include as a part that thought of it as a pen forced on you by your past karma. But nobody does, right? I'm saying independent of that, independent of dependent origination, sorry, it's not a, it's the sum of its parts is not the pen. Okay? We proved that because the sum of its parts is equally a chewable object. Okay? So if the sum of its parts was a pen, even a dog would come in and use it to write with. Alright? Alright. That used to confuse the hell out of me, and probably it would you, and probably frustrate thousands of Western Buddhists who have heard that explanation, you know. You are not your parts individually. You are not all of them together. You are not neither. You are not either. And it sounds really mystical, you know, and you're like, wow. And you go meditate on it for like 6 months, and you come back to the Lama and you say, I get it all, but why am I not in the sum of my parts? And they're like, well, you know, and you're like, you know, you don't get it, you know. Anyway, that's the trick. At this point in the text, maybe we will have a break. What do you think? It's not ending on time. We'll do one more question and then take a break. I'll end by 9:30, okay? This part. I was a diamond dealer, right? At this point in the text, Master Shantideva moves from a major discussion of one kind of emptiness to another. The distinction between the two is the answer to a very natural question which comes up in our minds when we begin to examine the emptiness of any object, especially our own selves. And this I call the Winston question, I think. Right? Was that Winston? Yeah. I heard you guys used to debate in the park, and this was always Winston's question, okay? The point is this. If somebody says, you know, the pen is not self-existent, the boss is not self-existently bad or good, if you're a thinking person, sooner or later, it's a Jim Halpern question also, he's here, okay. Sooner or later the question comes up in your mind, but are the parts of the pen self-existent? Or is the existence of the boss itself self-existent? Okay, I understand that whether I like him or not may be a projection of my karma, but is he also? And I understand that whether I identify this blue-white cylinder as a pen is up to my karma, but what about the blueness and the whiteness and the cylinderness? They seem to have some objective reality independent of my mind. You know, you can fight about whether it's a chewable object or a pen, but the fact that there's a blue and white cylinder out there is sort of inarguable, right? Whatever. And the answer is, until you check it, you're right. Matakma chepa. Until you start to examine the colors, you're right. But when you move down to the next level, it's the onion skin thing, right? When you move down to the next level and you start to, you know, examine, is the color, does the patch of color have any objective reality? You have to say no. Why? It's also a bunch of parts, left side and right side of the blue. And somebody is making me see it as a top of the pen blue. Or you don't have to say that. Somebody is making me see it as a blue cylinder. But it's really only the left half of a blue cylinder and the right half of a blue cylinder. Someone is making me see a blue cylinder. You cannot simultaneously entertain the thought of the left side and the right side. You see what I mean? You cannot simultaneously look at the left side and the right side. But you believe that. You really believe that. When I hold this up in your heart, you really believe that you're seeing both sides at the same time. It's impossible. You can't be. Your eye, if you track the human eye, you know, in science, you know, and there's this like laser thing. Your eye is going tick, 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 tick. It's seeing the left side, then the right side, then the left side, then the right side. And somebody is lying to you and saying it's one piece. And that's your karma. Is forcing you to see it that way. You are creating an image of a left side and a right side together as one thing. Where does that exist? It's not out here, honey. Okay? It's in your mind. All right? It doesn't exist out here. And then you can keep going down, 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 and you'll never find anything. You'll finally get tired and thereby establish emptiness. Okay? That's one way to meditate on emptiness. If you want emptiness meditation, that's one. It gets a little subtle, right? But you got it. Okay. Yeah. But excuse me. You just reminded me, okay? Sorry. Which means when you get down to the smallest building block of all physical matter, the atom itself, there's no reality. Okay? There is no physical reality. You got to get used to that. And when you get down to the smallest component of the human mind, which is what? The present instant of consciousness. Your present instant of consciousness. However short it is. It's still two smaller instants upon which somebody's mind is being forced to project their mind itself. Who? You. By what? Your karma. Your karma is also forcing you to think you have a mind. In the same way it's forcing you to think you see a whole top of a pen. Same thing, exactly the same thing. Very interesting. You know, your mind is the same. You don't have any objective reality. If you leave here, if you sit here, if you go to another country, if you stay here, if you die, if you don't die, it's all projections of your mind. Okay? On raw data that doesn't have any, that has its own raw data, that has its own raw data. Okay, you get it, right? In fact, if you think to start investigating through the different levels, that's your karma too. Get it? Yeah. Oh, because you can't get to it, it does exist? We would say, I believe what they would be saying in that case is that because you can't get to the end, it functions. You see what I mean? We don't deny that it functions. And we do say it exists. Yeah. Oh, I didn't say it didn't function, please. Go out and stand in front of a taxi cab. It will crush your legs. I didn't say that. I said it's not what it appears to be. It's not coming from where it appears to come from. The hardness of the steel of the taxi cab that breaks your knees is not being imparted by any physical reality of any atoms in the bumper. Its hardness is only coming from your projections forced on you by your past karma. If you didn't have those projections, you would see yourself being touched by a very nice person who's crossing the sidewalk with you. You see what I mean? It's very interesting. There is no reality in those atoms to make something hard. It's all coming from you. Okay? Got to get used to it. Why? It seems a little scary. No, you see, this is the way out. If that's the truth, you can design your future reality. Cool. I'll take Michael and Zoe's milkshakes all the time. And Two Boots Pizza, you know, unlimited supply. You know. Oh, you can use atoms. You can manipulate atoms. You say, I'd like to have, you know, pizza atoms in the future. That's okay. They're the expression of your karma. Okay? They're like henchmen doing the dirty work, but they're not the boss. The boss is your karma. Is it serious? No. Okay. We got it. Maybe. Okay, 13, and then we'll take a break. It says, what do we call the process of going down in levels through the parts, and the parts of the parts, and the parts of the parts of the parts, and so on, as a method to establish that things are actually empty? This is very important in the Tibetan. Tani tapi taktin sawe tena manye. Okay, in English, when we look for, and then I put in parentheses, self-existent, raw data, which is the object that we project onto, we don't find anything. And we thereby establish, in yet another way, the truth of emptiness. Okay? You can establish emptiness in a zillion ways. You had five great proofs. There happens to be about a zillion other ways to do it. Okay? But if you're going to do it this way, try to find a pen that exists from its own sign. And then you're going to come up with the parts. And then start examining each part. And then you're going to come up with the parts of each part. And then it's endless. And at the end, you're going to get tired. Your nose is going to hit zero. And you're going to give up and say, okay, everything's empty. There is no objective reality. There is no smallest building block of physical matter. There is no present instant of consciousness, which is indivisible. That proves that it's all a projection. You have to cook that. You have to mature in your thinking on that. And the maturation occurs. I gave you the great trick, which is to ask for the blessings of your lamas. Okay, you know, the maturation occurs. You will get a lot of, if you really want to see emptiness directly, do a lot of good deeds and purify your negative karma by using the four forces. It will start to clear away the what do they call that? The cataract. Okay, but the heavy duty thing. And I repeat that Jetsun Kapa spent half his life doing it, is to sit down or go to your lama directly and ask for their blessing. And there's nothing like that. The Yunden Shigyuma is not a separate work. It's a third of a larger work that Jetsun Kapa sat at Rajang in front of a statue of Atisha and begged for the blessings of Atisha. And he went into a vision for a month. Of all the teachers of the lineage, and they blessed his mind, and then later he saw emptiness. And you know, that's really the way to do it. And that's really the trick. to do it. So you have to mature in your thinking, and it's not self-existent. You know what I mean? The maturing of your thinking about emptiness is not self-existent. It depends on a hell of a lot of good deeds, and especially on asking for the blessings of enlightened beings. Okay, and that will speed up the process. And then a year from now, you will have insights about emptiness that you never dreamed were possible. But understanding emptiness is also not self-existent. It's also a projection. It also depends on incredible good karma. You have to go out and purposely try to collect that karma. And you do so primarily by asking for the blessings of enlightened beings. Okay? Can they give you blessings self-existently? No. Why? Why would they hold out? You know what I mean? Why would they wait for you to grovel before they give you blessings, you know? I'm not going to give you my blessing until you, like, put out water bowls for another 3 years, you know? Like, I'm really thirsty. You know what I mean? It's not like that. You know, they're not holding out. They're dying to give you those blessings. If they could give you the blessings without you doing any good deeds, they would have a long time ago. Okay? Get it? And they can't until you do some good deeds. And they can't make any exceptions. Because it's not their shtick. It's Mr. Karma's shtick, you know. So they can't break those rules. You know, you can ask them to break the rules of karma. I can't keep my vows. You know, I'm not interested in meditating. I'm too busy. Can I still understand emptiness? No. Okay. All right. I can't control myself though. Is it okay? No. Okay. You know, you have to keep your vows. You have to track them. It will purify your heart. Then you'll see emptiness. And then that creates the blessings from them. The blessings are not self-existent. They don't work just by asking. Okay. Asking does a lot if you believe in them. If you believe in who they are, you're actually stating that you believe in emptiness. So it's very cool and very smart to ask an enlightened being, I believe in you because things are empty. What's the connection between emptiness and Manjushri? Manjushri used to be a plain old schmuck. But because he was empty, he became a tantric deity. Okay? I believe in you because I understand that emptiness makes you possible. You see? If you're asking for a blessing, you already understand that that being is empty. That's already understanding emptiness. And the more you do it, the more you understand emptiness. And then they can bless your mind. Because who's blessing your mind? You are. Okay. Got it? Okay. Take a break. And we'll finish by 9:30, probably. Okay, I have a couple of announcements. There's going to be a ceremony for taking lifetime layman's vows on December 12th at 7 p.m. If you already have them, you don't need them again because they are lifetime vows. shucks. If you choose to take them, I don't give them lightly. I'm very serious about it. I will go over them very carefully. What you're committing to very basically is a no-brainer. Not killing humans, including fetuses. Not stealing something substantial from someone, not having illicit relations with another person's married, definite, fixed spouse, not lying about your spiritual life, you know, especially not claiming you've seen emptiness or deities or things like that if you have not seen them, and then not using intoxicants to the least bit or offering them to other people. If you're in a business meeting and you offer to pay for the lunch and somebody orders a cocktail and you can't get out of it, it's okay, all right? I mean, that happened to me, okay? But, I mean, it's not good, but what I'm saying is that knowingly volunteering, you know, preparing alcohol or drugs for other people or using them yourself. So it's to give up those five things. It's a no-brainer. So I don't do any of those. I wasn't planning to murder anybody or have an abortion, you know. Why should I take a vow? It's much more powerful. It's much, much more powerful, okay? And we'll get into it. I won't give them, it'll take a while to give them, okay? The ceremony is 5 minutes long. It'll probably take an hour and a half to tell you in detail what the vows are and stuff like that and what you're committing to. Prior to that, and as part of that, you will take refuge vows, okay? Refuge commitment. You can take the refuge commitment without taking the lifetime vows. And if those vows are too much for you, I encourage you to take the refuge commitments. It's 12 commitments. It's easy to keep. It's basically saying, I believe in all this stuff that you've been teaching us this year. And I commit myself to learn it well and to live by that. And that's all. A week from Monday, okay? Not this Monday, but a week from Monday at 6th Street, we will finish the daily practice class and we'll be going deeply into how to do your daily spiritual checkup, okay? And it's very, very important. You know, if you want to get to a tantric paradise in this life, this is the secret weapon, okay? And it's at 7 o'clock on Monday at 6th Street, okay? Venerable Punzok, Tipton Punzok, who's right here, will continue his popular meditation on Wednesday evenings, 7 o'clock. I really encourage you to come, okay? We're going to be off in December because nobody ever comes to class anyway. And January because I'll be in retreat for most of December and January. So I encourage you to take advantage of that during that time. And I encourage you to review what we did, okay? In the Gelugpa tradition, it's customary to go over three times what you studied before the next class. So, you know, you could get the video even. The videos are, I heard they're easier than the tapes, you know. You could just sit there and enjoy them and look at them again and try to figure out what those stupid mind-only guys were talking about. And, you know what I mean? So do that. Try to do that. Don't waste the time. These classes won't go on forever. This cycle, which started in 1991, I think. 93, was it? Oh, seems like a longer time. It will only go for 2 more years. Then I'll be doing a 3-year retreat. So that's I've committed to that. Okay, so don't waste the time. Okay, and use the time well. Use the time wisely. Okay, so don't waste those classes. It's almost in the monastery to go to a class once and then not review it is considered almost useless. They don't even count it as going to the class, really. If you don't hear it again and review it again, you won't get much benefit out of it. We debate it for every half hour of class we have, we debate it for about 5 hours. That gives you some kind of idea of the ratio. You know, if you should go over it. And to do it in groups is very, very powerful. Okay, it's very, very powerful to do that process in a group. So even with 2 or 3 other people, it's very powerful. Okay. By the way, it's my intention to continue, you know, full speed after the 3 years, okay? And so don't worry like that. And of course, I'll try to make some arrangements that people could maybe participate in some way, okay? So I'm not like running away like that. I'm actually trying to get closer. Okay, and we'll talk about that. What else? So you don't have to worry about that, okay? I mean, if you do your book, I have to come back, okay? That's glue. And it's actually everybody in this room should eventually get into this mode of thinking, okay, then I'll wind down my life and get enlightened, you know? You know, you should all be in that mode. Does the person disappear? No, okay? Not for you. If you keep your vows, the person is still there. And also you, if you keep your vows, you get them even sweeter every year. You know what I mean? And they can't get away from you. If you keep your book, frankly, if you really want to continue that, then you keep your vows and the person cannot leave. They can't get away. Your karma is forcing them to stay. And your practice should do that. I mean, your practice should start to take more and more priority in your life. Frankly, I've had a lot of complaints in the last year or so. I miss a lot of appointments. I skip, I seem to be late to things. I don't finish the reading on time. I'm not allowed to talk about my practice in much detail. But it takes 5 or 6 hours a day. And it takes more and more as my life goes on, and I'm very happy about it. And wonderful, wonderful things are happening. And I'm just saying that other things will suffer. And, you know, I will be late to things, and I might not show up somewhere, and you might not get your meeting on time sometimes. And it's not flippant, and it's not irresponsible. As your practice gets more and more serious, it will begin to happen to you that you can't break off a certain meditation, or it might go on 6 hours longer than intended, you know, and things happen like that, and you should be glad. Okay, so don't send me any more notes about the appointment I missed with you. Just be glad. Okay. No, I mean, if something's happening and you have to stay there another 6 hours or all night or for 2 nights, you have to stay. You can't just say, you know, sorry, I have a 2 o'clock, and your practice ideally should start to happen like that, okay? And don't think of it as something negative, it's the whole goal of what we're doing, you know what I mean, okay? Please come to Gene Smith's lectures, okay? He's a very eminent, for 20 years, 25 years, he saved all the Buddhist books coming out of Tibet. If it wasn't for him, you wouldn't have half the books you're studying. We wouldn't have half the courses you're going through. He's going to talk about how Buddhism came to Tibet. I think it's interesting because we have to have a game plan for America. And for that reason, he's teaching. He's not going to teach it from a Dharma point of view. He's going to teach it from a historical point of view. And I still think it's very important that you hear it. And frankly, I'd be embarrassed if a lot of people didn't come, because he has not given any such lectures for 20 years. And it took a lot of arm twisting to get him to agree. And then if only 10 people show up, like, I look like a real schmuck. So, you know, please come. He's a great man. We owe him a lot, you know. We owe him a lot. And you have to remember that, okay? While I'm gone, I'll be gone in December and January on retreat. I'd like to ask, as many people as possible, do retreats if you can. If you can, please send me your wishes, okay? It works, okay? Like, try to remember it. Mid-December to the third week of January, you know, out west somewhere. You know, please send your good wishes, and then it helps. It helps a lot. People who are parents, we have to fix the kids' class, okay? And we have to make it more serious. So think about it. And when I get back, it'd be third week of January, I'd like to have a meeting with the parents. It's been going really nice, except that it's a different 5 kids every week. And they don't learn anything that way. You have to take their spiritual life as seriously as yours. Just because they're shorter doesn't mean they don't deserve good teachings, okay? So we have to work on that. All right. Okay, last part of the final. You're not going to get out by 9:30. Okay. We're going to go a lot into the emptiness. On the final, there'll be a lot about the emptiness of your feelings. Okay? Your feelings. We had the 4 kinds of emptiness, the 4 awarenesses, and we were concentrating on the emptiness of your feelings. So the next question is, you know, if there's so many mental functions, why do 2 of them get to be separate skandhas or heaps? You know, why did the Buddha teach, out of all the mental functions, he took 2 of them and said, these are the 2 most important ones. And you're going to quote, Sobitsawa Gyabadan, Kore Gyuchi Rungyuchi, Semtinale Tsodan, Dushe Loshi Pumbashat, from the Abhidharma Kosha. And basically, the answer is, because they are the root of conflict and the cause of cyclic life, the Buddha gave them that status. Okay? Why? because of the capacity of discrimination, you say, this is good, this is bad, he's me, he's him, I'm me, this is mine, that's his. And that's one reason why discrimination is the mental, one of the mental functions that's a separate heap, and also feeling, because this feels good, this feels bad, I want this, I don't want that, like that. Because the Buddha taught that, some people have interpreted that the goal of Buddhism is that you somehow become some kind of vegetable and you can't say anymore. You know, you melt into the universe, and Amy Krantz's house and my house are the same thing, you know, and I get to move into your house, and, you know, and you know what I mean? And like that, it's not true, okay? It's not, do the Buddhas discriminate? Of course, you know. These are sentient beings who are suffering. That's too bad, you know. These are enlightened beings who are happy. That's great. I like my Buddha paradise. I don't like the hell realm that these beings are in. Of course they make distinctions. Would they like to suffer if they had the opportunity? This comes from your Judeo-Christian, you know, nailed on the thing. You know, of course they would if asked to, but they can't. Okay, why? Their karma is too pure. All right. They would gladly if it were necessary. You know, when they say bodhisattvas go to the hell realms to help people, don't worry about, they don't need any, you know, sunblock or anything. You know what I mean? They can't be harmed in the way that you and I could be. For them, it's just pleasurable to help people there. So, of course they make distinctions, and of course they have feelings. And it's not the goal of Buddhism to become some vegetable who doesn't discriminate between yours and mine and good and bad. It's the ignorant one that's bad. And that's the next question. Sakche. Sakche meaning impure feelings. What makes a feeling impure? If it triggers an action, an ignorant action, like if your desire for some milkshake triggers the ignorant action of pushing in front of other people, then it's dirty karma. You know, then it's a dirty feeling. Then it's impure, sakche, okay? If a feeling is an impure feeling if it would lead you to harm another being, to get what you want or to avoid what you don't want, okay? Are all feelings bad? No, Buddhas have feelings. Are dirty feelings bad? Yes. Why? Because under the influence of ignorance, you think you're going to get a milkshake faster if you cut in front of other people, which is totally, completely ignorant, and the milkshake you get doesn't exist. Okay? I love this question the most. Okay, 16. All right, the most brilliant question of all. Why will suffering ultimately be eliminated in every living being? Okay, why will suffering be eliminated in every living being eventually? Because all suffering, as we talked about in Maitreya's six-step process, all suffering in the world comes from misunderstanding things. You hurt other people because you want things ignorantly. You want them ignorantly because you think you can get them by hurting other people. Okay? You think you can get them by hurting other people because they seem to exist out there on their own, independent of your karma. Okay? But that's all based on a misunderstanding of the way things are. Okay? It's all based on that. And that's just incorrect. Sooner or later, you will figure it out. Okay? It's not true. It's false. Okay? They used to say in my high school, somebody, or it was Franklin. They were quoting Benjamin Franklin. A lie stands on one leg and the truth stands on two. You know, it was advice not to start little lies, because you forget what you told one person, and then you have to keep remembering to tell other people the same lie, and then sooner or later you contradict yourself, you know? Like, you forget who it was that you lied to in different ways, and he was saying it's a lot easier just to tell everybody the truth, you know? And then you don't have to remember, you know, the lie that you told person A or person B, you know? The same thing is true about reality. You know, sooner or later, the viewpoints which I have described tonight will cover the universe. You know, people said we should change the name to American Buddhist Movement or something, and I said, "How about intergalactic?" You know, why think small? Sooner or later, this viewpoint must spread through the mind of every living being in the in this universe, because the opposite is a lie, and sooner or later it gets exposed. Okay, sooner or later, ignorance's viewpoint. No living being can go endlessly through time putting up with a viewpoint that makes them unhappy. Okay? Sooner or later, the viewpoints which I've described that don't work and which are incomplete will be rejected naturally. It's a natural evolution that stupid viewpoints that don't get you what you want, you will reject them. It's like bad music, you know. Anyway, they will die out because they are based on a misperception. And sooner or later, you see the truth. Okay? The truth will out. Okay? Name and describe the meaning of the names to each of the three kinds of compassion. Okay. One of them, it's called the compassion which focuses on things, number one. It sees that people are changing by the instant, that they are processes that are changing from moment to moment. Okay. And by deduction, that state of mind can no longer believe in a soul or a permanent self. And by deduction, that state of mind thinks, well, then where is this person coming from? And by deduction, that state of mind eventually will say, I think this person might be my projection. And to feel love for a person like that is the first kind of compassion. Okay? It's like understanding the partness thing about people and then having love for them. Okay? And that kind of love is much more useful because it understands how to really make them happy. Okay? The second kind of compassion is called, in English, compassion which focuses on nothing or the emptiness of the person. And get this, it understands that every other idea about where people come from is totally false. It understands, as it looks at a suffering being, it understands that every other theory about where their suffering is coming from is totally incorrect. Their suffering was not made by some sadistic creator. Their suffering was not made by some Big Bang. Their suffering was not made by some socioeconomic system that you don't agree with. You know, communism, socialism, capitalism. Their suffering was not created by those things. And especially, they are not created randomly because they are caused. They have their causes. They are not just accidents that are happening to people. It looks at the person and it rejects all those other viewpoints. You see what I mean? That's an emptiness of those other viewpoints. That's the emptiness of the truth of those other viewpoints. Every single suffering being is totally free of the truth of any of those wrong viewpoints. Because that doesn't exist. And never did. And never will. And that's the same as a two-headed purple full-sized elephant rampaging through the Quaker house. Okay? So that's even more powerful than the first kind of compassion. The first one is cool. The second one is brilliant. Okay. Number three, compassion which focuses simply on a living being, it doesn't make any of those distinctions. It's just looking at people and saying, too bad, I wish they had money, I'll give them money, that's how they will get the money. Can you give money to anybody? Can you give money to anybody? Of course you can. Last night we met a guy, should I tell him? It's kind of cool. We met a derelict that wanted to give us money, and that's karma. Okay, but anyway, I'm not kidding. Anyway, can you give them money? Yes, you can. Can you give them self-existent money? No. Can you give them money that they did not earn personally with the sweat of their brow? No. They earned anything you give them, they earned. Okay? How? Good karma, if they like money. Okay? All right. But this state of mind doesn't make those distinctions. Number three, just feel sorry for somebody. Look at that poor old self-existent derelict. I'll give them some self-existent money that I self-existently worked for, and I hope they get a self-existent job. Okay? And you think you're doing them a big favor. You see what I mean? Does that mean you shouldn't give money to them because it's just their karma and their projection. You're not doing anything. Of course not. Okay? You must give them all the money you can. You see what I mean? It's no contradiction. If you try to help someone who's being mugged and you succeed, it's because they helped someone in the past. If you're trying to help someone who's being mugged and the mugger beats you up too, it's because neither one of you helped anybody in the past. Does that mean you shouldn't help them? Of course not. You must help them. It's your bodhisattva vow. It's your responsibility. You aren't a real person if you don't try to help them. Okay? What will be the result of helping them? Mainly, you will live a long life. Okay? All right. Number 18. Give a general description of the object which the middle way denies. That is, describe what it is that emptiness is empty of and give a metaphor for it. The gakcha is what we're looking for. Gakcha means a self-existent thing. What is its ontological status? It never existed. It never will exist. It can't exist now. Okay? It's a two-headed purple elephant. What is an example of the gakcha? Money that could buy you a Michael and Zoe's milkshake. There ain't no such thing. Let's start with that. Let's start with the basis of our whole culture. You know, it doesn't exist. That money doesn't exist. Okay? That's a gakcha. And the fact that it doesn't exist is emptiness. That's emptiness. So when people say emptiness is some kind of green light, like fuzzy yellow glow in your mind, or watching your thoughts trail off into smoke, or some crap like that, it's totally wrong. And it's destroying the happiness of many people to say those things. Okay? Describe the three different interpretations of what dependent origination means. That's easy, right? The first three schools of Buddhism, which are wrong or incomplete, and were taught by the Buddha, okay, because it helps people, say that the ultimate meaning of dependent origination is that things come from their causes. The lower half of the fourth school, the lower Madhyamika school, says things depend on their parts, and that's dependent origination. If you're like me, you will sit there month after month and hear that from lamas and say, what's that got to do with my happiness? You know, I don't get it. And then when you reach 4.5 school, you're happy. They're your projections. Dependent origination means things depend on their existence on what? On your projections forced on you by your past karma. Ah, the connection between karma and emptiness. Okay? There must have been a connection somewhere there. The poor old Buddha, 50,000 pages of work on karma, 50,000 pages of work on emptiness. There must be some connection between the two. There it is. Okay? Dependent origination is the fact that everything exists depending on your projections forced on you by your past karma. Any other way of existing is non-existent, and the absence of that in the universe is called emptiness. Okay? All right. We're almost done. Number 20. Master Shantideva says, quote, there is no difference between reaching nirvana and not reaching nirvana. People love this one. This is a favorite one for Tricycle magazine articles and stuff. You know, oh, it doesn't matter. Do what you like, you know. Keep your morality, don't keep your morality. Be good, don't be good, you know. Suffer, don't suffer. It's all the same. Reach a space where you don't mind anymore, you know. I always say, bring him here. I'll use a dental drill on this guy. You know, we'll see if he minds anymore. I've never found a taker in 20 years of teaching, you know. Find me the guy. I'm still waiting, okay. Of course nirvana and not reaching nirvana ain't the same thing at all. What he meant was they are both equivalent from the point of view of being empty of any natural existence. They don't exist on their own. They are not existing naturally. Okay, they're not. They're not like that. From that point of view, they're equivalent. And thank God. Why? If not reaching nirvana was self-existent, or if reaching nirvana was self-existent, you could never get them. You see? You could never avoid one and get to the other. Okay? If nirvana existed by itself, what is nirvana? It's looking at Winston's brain. It's for Winston to look at his thoughts and realize he's never going to have anger again in his whole life. You see? And that's a projection. Okay, your own mind is a projection. The thoughts you hear are totally dependent on your own karma. If you had different karma, you'd be hearing this confused anger thoughts. But if you clean up your karma, you'll be hearing the sweet silence of an arhat. No more anger. Never again. You see what I mean? The mind itself is the same as the pen. Alright? You gotta get used to that. In that sense, nirvana and suffering are the same thing. And only in that sense. Come on. Okay. I'm not picking on Tricycle. Sorry. They have some great articles in there from time to time. Okay. I'm just kidding, okay? I think I broke a few vows there. Alright. State the relationship between natural nirvana and regular nirvana. Natural nirvana is the fact that all things are empty. And as I just said, thank God things are empty. If your mind wasn't empty, you could never project a new mind. Okay? If your mind wasn't empty, then all those thoughts running around in your mind would be anger from their own side and you couldn't change them. You'd always be here. You'd always be suffering. Okay? If your body and mind and your channels and chakras and tigles and all that stuff, if all that stuff was self-existent, you're in big trouble. You know, if the condition of your chakras is not, if it existed from its own side, and if it were not a projection of your mind, you could never reach enlightenment in this lifetime. Okay? Impossible. You see, thank goodness that all that stuff is a projection. Now you can do something with it, okay? That's extremely important. What I just said is extremely important. Okay? That's the basis of the success, of your success in this life. If you can get to that point and understand that particular emptiness, then you can work with stuff. Okay. Explain the best method for truly understanding the classical proofs on emptiness. We did that already. Skip that. What was it? Ask for the blessings of your lamas. Okay. All right. And all the lamas of the lineage. It's hard, right? You can't picture them. What did Master Shantideva look like? I don't know. Like a Bengali, probably, you know. He was, whatever. You know, it's hard to visualize them. It's hard to ask somebody for help when you don't have any idea what they look like, how tall, how skinny, you know. Did he smile or not? You know, it's hard. Visualize your root lama. They are an emanation of those other lamas, so no problem, you know. All right. 23. Name the principal benefit of performing an act of dedication and the principal problem of failing to do so. Principal benefit is even small virtues like giving a piece of bread to a bird start to recycle. They start to perpetuate themselves and they snowball. You can say the benefit is snowballing, the snowballing principle. Buddhas are living off of that. Okay? That's the fusion that runs Buddha paradises, you know, is the fact that you can get it to snowball. You can get into an ever rising, self-perpetuating cycle, and that's the whole point. Okay? Every time you get something, you give it away again. Okay? Every time something wonderful happens to you, you use it to serve other beings with. And it just doesn't stop. You know, it's like the American capitalist system, which I was a part of, and I understand it quite intimately, which is to keep borrowing money to stay afloat. And the investors will keep giving because they're afraid to lose everything they've already invested, which you've already lost. But they keep, you know, I mean, it's a self-perpetuating thing. The money isn't there anymore. If all the investors ask for their money back, there's less money in the company than the sum total of everything they originally put in. But if they keep giving, you won't have to tell them that. And they know that, so they keep giving, you know. And they get their interest, and then it goes for a while, you see. It's like that. Okay. 24. As he closes his presentation on the stages of the path, Master Shantideva dedicates the virtue of his great accomplishment to the continued flourishing of the Buddhist teachings in the world. And he uses a metaphor to describe it. State the metaphor and explain it. That's where you're going to get into It's the medicine, Menchikbu, right? The one and only medicine for the suffering of mankind. And I repeat, you know, if you want to develop compassion, you want to feel compassion. Everybody would like to feel compassion. It's hard, right? I mean, someone bumps you on the subway the right way, all the compassion stuff goes out the window in about a minute. You know, and I'm speaking from experience. I got bumped today, and I forget when it was. Where were we? It was something. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I reserved a room for a teaching, and somebody stayed over, and I got mad at them right away. And, you know, it's weird. It tends to all go out the window. But anyway, I lost my train of thought. Where was it? Menchikbu, only medicine, means... If you want to develop compassion, get into the habit of truly recognizing that all the suffering of mankind is unnecessary. You see what I mean? It's an accident. It's a mistake. It's not necessary. It doesn't have. It's unnecessary. You see what I mean? I mean, we tend to think of the suffering of humanity as being a necessary evil, but that's not true. It's an error. It's based on an error, and it could be fixed in one generation. You see what I mean? If you people in this room were truly dedicated, I always think of the IRA. You know how many active terrorists in the IRA? They're holding England at bay. How many active terrorists in the IRA? How many people have actually set off bombs in the IRA? 50 people. You know, 50 people are holding millions at bay. Why? Just dedication. They believe what they're doing. You know, if the people in this room work their asses off to understand this viewpoint and to achieve it themselves, then you could, in one generation or two, prevent the suffering of mankind. That's pretty amazing. You know, if you really worked hard, you could stop the carnage called life. You know what I mean? And it doesn't have to go on. It's unnecessary. It's an error. It's a mistake. It doesn't have to go on. You could stop it. You know, you could help stop it. It's very profound. That's very profound. Okay? But it's Menchikbu. You know, frankly, this is the viewpoint which could remove it. And the others cannot. Okay? That's all. Menchikbu. That's what he's saying. Last question. 10 minutes early. Not bad. Describe and explain the final act of Master Shantideva in his spiritual classic, The Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. The very last thing he does is very typical and very, very brilliant. It shows who he is. He bows down to his lamas. You know what I mean? He makes a prostration to his lamas. Okay. And as I said, whether or not you get all this and whether or not it succeeds, whether or not you reach a tantric paradise in this life, whether or not you're able to escape death or not, whether or not you really meet all these beings that I've been talking about, which you can, it all depends on meeting a lama and having this relationship with them. It all depends on that. You must find someone who has done it, and then you must glue yourself to that person. And it's like learning violin or anything. If you think you can do this without a teacher, when you can't learn, you know, that's like thinking you could learn physics or astrophysics or advanced calculus or to play violin for the in Carnegie Hall or something without a teacher. It's harder than that, you know. To think that you could do it without a qualified teacher is ridiculous. So you have to find one, and then you really, really have to seriously devote yourself to what they teach. You know, you have to listen to them, you have to follow what they're saying, you have to practice it. And then you have a chance. And otherwise it's hopeless, you know. You must find a teacher. That's what he's saying at the end. That's what he means when he says, you know, the last thing he does is to bow down to his teacher. His teacher happens to be Manjushri. And he does bow down to Manjushri, but it's like that, okay? And thank you for... it's like one of the holiest moments in my life to have gone through Bodhisattva Charavatara with you, and you know, I thank you for that. And for me, the karma of what we just did is very intense. It's things in my own life, it's extremely intense right now. So, and I know it's because we did it together and that you asked me to teach it. So I appreciate that. And I thank you for that. Yeah, okay. We're going to do Ken Rinpoche's long life prayer also. I mean, the link in the lineage is through him, and you pray for his long life, that he stays. We've been doing really good with Rinpoche, you know. We kept him up. He's almost 80 now. And I was thinking this afternoon that, you know, we could probably keep him for another 50, 60 years at least, if we're really good. You know, it could be the first Lama to be recognized as not dying. You know what I mean? And that would be kind of cool. So let's try, all right?
Yombe so. Lo men ga wa se je jin la tan dong tong gen me je yin den den to da chan se jin me
Also, one last thing. I wanted to personally thank all the people who helped with the class. I've been to other centers a lot in the last year, all over the country, and they all have like volunteer problems. They can't find enough people to help, and they don't have any money, and they're all suffering, and blah, blah, blah. And we used to have that problem, like 4 years ago or something. I think now we counted, there's something like 40 people spending a lot of their time helping this place run. Every aspect, I think there's 700 people have asked for the correspondence courses, 10,000 tapes have gone out, all those papers, whoever sent them in, corrected, all the work that goes into this, all the funds to do it, everything else, everything is going like, we have almost more people than we know what to do with. I mean, people have been really, really helpful. And I have the opposite problem, you know. We have too many good people, you know. And I'm really, really proud of that. And it seems like the fruits of the teaching, you know, that people want to help. And so I just want to thank all the people. I can't thank them. It's too many now. I used to, like, last class it took like a half hour, right? And so it's too many to thank, but every aspect of this class was taken care of by some. Many, many people were spending up. There's a certain group of people that were up many nights, all night, and stuff like that. And so I want to thank all of those people a lot. Okay? And that's all. Thank you. All right? So no prostration, okay? All right.
Sanshi Bhagi Jashi Neta Jam Vira Vinshi Nyende Nyampadi Sange Shindu Mithe Uwagi Jogunanda Shiva Jaka
This is the end of Class 11. You have been listening to A Guide to the Bodhisattva Way of Life, Part 3, with Geshe Michael Roach, presented by the Asian Classics Institute. The Asian Classics Institute is dedicated to preserving the pure teachings and practice of Buddhism. For a listing of other topics available, write to the Asian Classics Institute, P.O. Box 20373, New York, New York, 10009, or call 212-475-7752.